So I will kindly ask Stephen Hollander to take over and introduce us to the world of raising money through the capital markets. And we have with us an esteemed group of panelists, seasoned bankers who all came from abroad, and they will share their insight with us. So please, gentlemen, I leave it up to Stephen. And
thank you, Nicholas. My name is Stephen Hollander. I'm counsel at Watson, Farley & Williams. My practice focuses on the capital markets, private equity, mergers, acquisitions, and general corporate matters. I'll briefly introduce our esteemed panel members, and we'll jump right into it. First is Jeff Pribor, who is the global head of shipping investment banking at Jefferies & Company. Previously, Jeff was Executive Vice President and CFO of General Maritime from September 2004 to February 2013. His major accomplishments during his tenure at General Maritime included successful hostile takeover defense, leverage recapitalization with a $500 million special dividend to shareholders, a major financial restructuring, involving a replacement of existing secured debt held by 20 banks with approximately $1 billion of debt and common equity. And most recently, Jeff guided General Maritime through a prearranged Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceeding. Next to Jeff is Nicholas Stillman, who serves as Managing Director of the Investment Banking Division of Clarkson Capital Markets, the boutique investment banking arm of Clarkson PLC, who serves the shipping and offshore oil sectors. Nicholas joined Clarkson's in 2010, where he helped establish its U.S. investment banking operations in early 2011. Prior to Clarkson's, Nick spent 6 years at the Maritime Group of Jefferies. Next to Nick is Elizabeth Cabot, who's currently the Vice President in the Industrials Investment Banking Group at Wells Fargo. She joined Wells Fargo in 2012 and focuses on shipping, rail, trucking, and logistics. Prior to joining Wells Fargo, Elizabeth was a vice president at Citi in the transportation group, where she was responsible, again, for covering key clients in the shipping, rail, airline, aircraft leasing, and infrastructure sectors. Next to Liz is Chris Wires, who joined Stifel in 2012 and is a senior member of the Maritime Investment Banking Practice. Prior to joining Stifel, Chris was a managing director and head of maritime and transportation investment banking at FBR Capital Markets. Chris also ran the Maritime and Transportation Investment Banking Practice for Fortis Securities and was a senior member of the Bear Stearns practice as well. And last but certainly not least is Christo Volpicelli, who is the Managing Director at Citigroup, where she leads the firm's shipping investment banking practice in New York. In 2014, her team has led deals in all the sectors, dry sector, LNG, tanker, and container ship sector. And she has advised many shipping issuers through the IPO process and through navigating the markets once the companies have gone public. So I guess with that background, I think it's pretty evident that the panel is certainly seasoned and certainly knows what they're talking about. So this panel was convened to talk about capital markets, and I guess the first question, which I'll start with Jeff because he's the closest to me, is how do you see private companies accessing the capital markets today? Equity, debt, what markets? I guess I'll try to leave it open-ended, but how do you see companies that want to get to the public get there?
Thank you, Stephen. You're starting with me because I'm the oldest. I've been here the longest. And also, before I answer that question, it's so unfair that we get to do all these in English. I just want to try this, and if it works, let me know. Telo, nasas afersista. Thank you very much for the invitation, Nick. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you. You're very kind for a very bad accent. So now I'm so nervous about that, I don't remember the question.
Excellent.
is what access is there to the public markets? It's all everyone's been talking about all day. Nick, I think you put this together a while ago, and you said preparing for the rebound. I think that those that were prepared are, as Isabella pointed out to us just a few minutes ago, jumping right through that window and heading out now. The biggest number of shipping IPOs we saw in the last 10 years, 2000 was, Isabella, was the biggest year for IPOs altogether, but 2007 was the biggest year for shipping IPOs, I think. And we had five last year, two MLPs and three what I call growth shipping IPOs, and every indication that it'll be higher this year than that. So I think that's the main thing. But at the same time, we have existing public companies taking advantage of the fact that they stayed the course and remained public and dealt with the tough times, and they're accessing public markets now to grow, because I think this is how it's supposed to work. The markets are there. Investors are interested in shipping at the bottom of the cycle, but when it started to head up. So now is the time when we can see more. We're seeing more interest from U.S. investors, broadly speaking.
Thank you. I guess. Nick, based on the number of IPOs that I've completed, I guess some very fairly recently, as we've heard from multiple sources today, do you think that shipping companies are out of the woods, so to speak, when it comes to IPOs, or do you think there's still a little bit more to go?
I mean, I think broadly speaking, the market is absolutely open for IPOs today in shipping. I think the bigger criteria is in fact that scale is a very important factor right now in the market. The bigger the company, the easier the deal, all valuation issues aside. And so as long as companies are going public with enough scale and liquidity and deal size, then I think the markets are absolutely wide open. And it's just now beginning, but all the sponsor-backed entities that went public via or semi-public via OTC listings in Norway, et cetera, and a bunch of private equity-backed groups, all of these vehicles will eventually end up public in either Norway or New York. And so there's not only a tremendous amount of capital being raised on a regular way basis, but as that cycle evolves, these will all end up as public companies. And because that's frankly what all the investors that have bought in to date want. And so I think the market has absolutely turned. It is wide open as long as you have enough scale.
Great. Thanks. Liz, there's been a lot of talk the last, year or two about green eco-vessels. What are your thoughts on companies that do or do not have these vessels when they're trying to access the capital markets?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether you have them or not in terms of what your view is. But I think going forward, it's important to be able to tell a differentiated story. And if part of your differentiated story is having the eco-type vessels, I think that's really important. I think that regardless, people with high-quality fleets are going to be able to access the market. And I think the green story is a part of that. But I think more importantly, it's having a young fleet, having very high-quality assets. So.
Thanks. Chris, are there any consistent characteristics? I mean, we were saying that the market is fairly open, or at least there's a good, better chance for companies now to access the markets than perhaps a couple years back. So are there any consistent characteristics among successful IPOs in the last 12, 24 months that ship owners can look towards?
Well, the biggest characteristic you see today with at least the C-Corp structured IPOs, as Nick mentioned, is they're all big and they're all being sold almost entirely institutionally, and the institutions demand a big liquid public flow before they would invest. So those are really the folks today that are accessing the market. They're all accessing the market at very kind of near asset value as well. Most investors or institutional investors are not willing to pay big asset value premiums, and most of the C-Corp companies that try to go public don't have, charter rates on their assets today that support a meaningful yield. So it's not yet kind of, marketable very easily to retail investors, which were kind of the primary investors in IPOs that got done in the kind of 05 to kind of 08 timeframe. So that's the big difference, I would say. I think we'll start to see the markets evolve as time goes on, as markets improve and charter rates get higher and companies can start to pay, dividends again. I think you'll start to see more retail participation. You'll start to see an opportunity for, smaller cap companies to come public again.
Thanks. Krista, what can a shipping company do to prepare itself for an entry into the capital markets without stepping on the toes of potential future speakers here? I think it's something that it's not just having, I would say, in addition to Chris's answer of having, you know, the fleet ready to go, but is there anything else that a shipping company can do to position itself better?
In terms of positioning for a public market exit, at least as far as the U.S. is concerned, I think one of the biggest items is just recognizing the time that the process takes and the amount of internal preparation that there is with respect to having audited financial statements available, for example. Jeff made a good comment at the beginning, which is that many of those companies who started to get prepared early, not knowing when the market would open, are the ones who are able to take advantage of things today. And so I think that you know, being prepared to go public is a process that can take 4 to 6 months. You have a benefit of going confidentially through the SEC. And so there's time and dollars that need to be spent with accountants and lawyers. Us bankers, unfortunately, don't get paid until you actually do a transaction, but we'll happily give you free advice ahead of that. So it really boils down to being prepared. You know, there are a lot of companies thinking about accessing the public markets. We do believe there is a lot of investor interest there. We've been getting reverse inquiry by investors across all of the sectors wanting to find good companies to put their money to work. They see that asset values are appreciating. They see that equity values are starting to appreciate. And there's a lot of pent-up demand to invest in the sector for the right opportunities. So I think that the more that you talk to your advisors collectively and then start that process of being prepared, the better off you'll be when the time comes.
Thanks. Chris, you had mentioned you know, companies paying dividends. Is that something? Can you possibly expand on that and say talk about whether companies accessing the capital markets are looking to pay dividends immediately, or something that they should just kind of keep in the back of their heads?
So I think in shipping, you know, it's a very efficient structure, at least in the U.S. markets, for paying dividends, since corporations pay no tax and dividends get, you know, favorable tax treatment in the United States. So I think most companies that have gone public in the United States intend to pay dividends. But most are in kind of growth mode now. So I think investors who are buying these new IPOs are, you know, believing in these growth stories, and they're believing in kind of asset appreciation kind of coming as markets begin to recover. So, you know, I think most people have kind of taken the view of kind of no dividends or small dividends at the onset of the IPO, with kind of larger, you know, dividends to follow when the markets recover. And that's kind of the story that seems to sell best with investors today.
Yeah, can I jump in there? I remember this is interesting for me to see from this side, because I remember tackling this issue as a CFO on the other side and wondering what kind of dividend policy to have and when. And I think, you know, what we talk about now is, unless you're a structured dividend company like an MLP, which is, you know, yield from the beginning, it's if you, Mr. Ship or Ms. Ship Owner, can take the money that you otherwise would dividend and reinvest in your business, you know, at a better rate than we would take it, you know, and reinvest it just in the stock market, then please do that. You know, keep the money and grow. So I agree with Chris that either no or just a very small dividend. If you have too big a dividend that's not supporting enough to support yield like an MLP, you're just wasting your money, or showing a lack of conviction that you really think there's good assets to buy in your sector.
Thanks. Nick, Jeff just mentioned MLP structures, which obviously are yields from day one, but there's been a number of corporate, the MLPs 2011, 2012 were actually, you know, there were a number of IPOs in the U.S. capital markets of MLPs, which are master limited partnerships. And in the last year, they've also been a number of corporations, more traditional structures, that have gone public in the U.S. Do you think investors prefer either type of structure, or do you think it really just matters on the asset?
I think the difference is mostly in the investors that are buying each security. The MLP market is fundamentally a more of a retail market, and then from an institutional perspective, it's income funds or closed-end funds that have shareholders that are retail investors, but they package the money together and invest institutionally. For those types of investors, the MLP, when properly structured with long-term charters and a balance sheet that is sustainable and a dividend payment that's sustainable, have been very attractive to, you know, income funds and retail investors. Whereas the C-Corp structure that the, you know, regular shipping companies, the investors today are fundamentally making a bet on the cycle. There's almost no one that is, you know, looking for dividends today. They are trying to play the cycle just as a, you know, traditional ship owner would. They are thinking that they're timing the cycle right, and they're investing now. They want the companies to, in fact, pay little to no dividend and reinvest in ships and grow the fleet and try and scale up. So, you know, what we've seen is that in all of these deals for C-Corps, the institutional interest has been extremely high. You can, you know, what used to be in 2004 to 2008 wave of IPOs, you know, a critical factor was an investment bank's retail capability to kind of push a deal across the line if you needed it. Whereas right now, there are numerous deals getting done 100% institutionally and are oversubscribed. And those institutions are fundamentally betting on the cycle and don't care about dividends. And in fact, probably don't want you to pay dividends.
If I could add to the MLP discussion, I fully agree with the comment that investors today within shipping are agnostic to sector. They're really looking at the fundamental dynamics of the company and where growth will come. And certainly in a lot of the more cyclical sectors, there's a lot of opportunity today. Why some shipping companies have decided to access the MLP structure is just because of, from a business model perspective, as well as an access to capital perspective, through the cycles, MLPs have had a bit more access. I think the number is something in excess of 10% of all equity issuance last year was from MLPs. There's over 100 MLPs listed in the U.S. Now, many of those are much larger companies, such as the U.S. midstream players. And so of the shipping MLPs, there's only 7 listed today, so it's a much smaller set. But as you think about access to different pools of capital, yes, MLP is a retail sector, but there are also many dedicated institutions that have popped up today. So I think either is a viable route for sure. It's just the MLP sector is a bit broader in terms of definition.
If I could just add one more thing to that, too. I think not all shipping companies are meant to be MLPs. I think if you look at sort of the long-term contracted nature of them, it's suitable for a certain type of structure. And I think at the bottom of the cycle, as people are on spot charters and shorter-term charters, a lot of those companies don't make sense for an MLP.
All right. Thank you. Krista, you mentioned that a lot of investors are sector agnostic. Is there any particular sector that you think in the next 12 months would be more successful than another to access the capital markets?
Well, I guess to be clear, I don't mean investors are completely sector agnostic. I may have misspoke. I think that they are certainly paying attention to the underlying dynamics. However, there have been very positive dynamics in many of the sectors that have provided them an opportunity for to invest. You know, you've certainly seen a lot of momentum amongst product today, where there's been more dollars raised focused on the crude space. I believe that we've gotten investors asking us about dry and container and have raised some capital there. So I think it's really just looking at the individual company, how they're focused on playing that particular sector. People are focused on the same dynamics as they have in the past, which is the order book, and how is supply going to develop, and so that will continue to be important. But I think the good news is it feels, at least from where we sit, that you do have those attractive fundamentals in many of the areas.
I agree with everything Krista said. I think it's worth drilling down on for a minute. When I arrived at Jefferies a year ago, it was right around the time of this conference a year ago, and I wasn't unfortunately able to come, but I think, because I remember it well, coming back to investment banking, there was only one sector that anyone was really talking about in terms of access to capital, and that was product tankers. And there, you know, one company had started and has continued with several investment banks, including my friend Eric in the front row, to raise a lot of money in that sector. But and I'm tempted to describe it as a rotation, but then that's the wrong word. Because rotation is like when you rotate out of defensive stocks and into cyclical stocks, you leave one and go to another. That's not it. It's been an evolution. Product tanker stocks were the first, but they've stayed of interest, right? Investors know them well and are still of interest. There's still stuff going on there right now as we speak. Then it was dry bulk. People will forget quickly, but a lot of people in dry bulk, when I started again a year ago, said about dry bulk, said it's going to be 2015, 14 for sure, maybe even later, you know, before you really see a dry bulk recovery. And then Capesize rates spiked in August, and maybe dry bulk's coming back sooner. And crude, I know so many people that absolutely wrote off crude forever. I mean, maybe forever in Wall Street is a year or 2 years, so maybe it's your definition of forever. But it was absolutely left for dead, is a phrase I use all the time. You couldn't get anyone to talk about crude. Now it's all any hedge fund in New York wants to see is bring me something in the crude sector, please. You know, so there's been this evolution sector by sector, and there's a couple left, you know, and we'll see that over time supply and demand will work their way through, and we'll get to all the sectors, in my opinion.
Well, Chris, I guess we can't really talk about capital markets unless we probably also talk about private equity, at least at the same time for a little bit. There has been some recent success of private equity shops exiting through the capital markets. Do you think there's going to be a lot of companies that would otherwise not have exited as soon as they did, or as soon as they do, because of the previous success? Or do you think private equity shops are going to be looking to hold on for a little bit longer?
I think you know, most private equity that wants to invest in shipping has invested in shipping at this point. I think there's still more money to be invested, but you know, I'd say most of the money that will be invested in this cycle has been invested. And you know, as was mentioned previously, like almost all of the private equity funds want to get their vehicles public. Some have big vehicles, you know, that they know can get public on their own. Some have smaller vehicles, so there's lots of discussions going on around kind of merging smaller vehicles to create kind of bigger vehicles that have size and scale to go public. But realistically, you know, there could be, you know, north of 10 companies, you know, possibly north of 15 companies that try to go public this year in the U.S. market, shipping companies. And, you know, I think the biggest kind of concern most PE has right now is, you know, is there going to be kind of a big enough market in the U.S. to get all of these companies public? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to it. My view is, you know, as long as the markets kind of stay like they are with, you know, people believing there's a lot of upside remaining, I do think these deals will get done. But I think there's going to be, you know, a lot of price pressure in the markets. And, you know, I think valuations are going to stick around asset value for a little while until, you know, a number of these IPOs get through the market. And then at some point, you know, investors will start, you know, bidding up prices probably around the actual recovery. But I think there's, you know, there's a lot of PE and a lot of hedge funds that are looking to access the markets this year.
Liz, there's been some, for a company that's about to go public that manages their vessels in-house, is there a benefit, or I should say, do you think that there is some sort of requirement or expectation that the management company be included? Or is a company that manages its vessels with a third party still going to be able to access the capital markets?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that to the extent that you can demonstrate an alignment of interest with your shareholders, and whether that's through having your management company in-house, I think that's very important. I think especially for a story that on the margins might have some issues, I think for companies that are in industries or asset classes that are very in demand, I think maybe you can sell through that. But I think at the end of the day, having the management company in-house is really a plus, and it demonstrates a real alignment of interest and minimizing conflicts, I think.
Yeah, but sometimes you can't. And sometimes it's not an option the way the nature of a family company that might be diverse across a number of sectors. So I absolutely agree with you, Liz, that it's a preference, and it's just one less box to sell through in an IPO if you do have an integrated. But if you don't, then the next best thing is to structure really cleanly, transparently, no cost or low cost contracts between the outside management company and the shipping company that the investors are coming into, because you can't. It just isn't quite the case that always it could be inside, I think.
And if I could add one more thing, I think that raises an interesting point on the private equity side as well. I think that, you know, there was an interesting comment earlier on the panel this morning that was talking about how do you convince your shareholders, if you're a private equity company that's exiting, that you're not selling at the top of the market? And I think demonstrating that you're raising money for growth and for primary proceeds as opposed to selling down, I think it's just one more thing that's beneficial in an IPO.
Thanks. Jeff, for companies that are looking to access the debt capital markets, do you see them preferring to issue, let's go to the Norwegian bond market, which has done very well the last couple of years, and or perhaps either U.S. public market, the U.S. capital markets, or even 144A private bonds?
That question misses the point, with all respect, Steve. It's not about the Norwegian bond market versus the U.S. bond market. It's about the capital markets being available at all, really, on the debt side. You know, for years, there really wasn't a good alternative to bank financing and shipping. It's not that there wasn't a Norwegian bond market. There was. The U.S. bond market was there, too. But having conveniently forgot how bad it was in 1998, 99, 2000. But the markets were there. But bank finance was so plentiful and so cheap, there was just no reason to do it. But now what you're seeing in the U.S. and in Norway is a debt capital markets alternative. Which is beginning to compete, with the banks, especially given the fact that shipping bank capital is less plentiful than it used to be. So you combine a moderate coupon with zero amortization for the full life of the bond in the U.S. or for a few years in Norway versus a little lower coupon but amort right from the beginning in the bank market begins to look a little more interesting. So we saw, obviously, in the end of last year an attractive offering for Ellison that worked for them. They didn't want to be public, and so with equity, so the bond market worked very well for them. It's a good alternative, and we've seen a lot more people looking into that as an alternative these days.
I would just add to that. I've seen over the last few years, kind of the cost of capital differential between banks and the capital markets, compress quite a bit. Before the financial crisis, it was a no-brainer. You'd do almost all of your financing in the bank market if you could. But there's definitely kind of a term loan market that's developed in the United States. That kind of mimics the bank market in some ways. It's still more expensive than the bank market, but it's affordable relative to what most shipping companies can afford to pay, and as Jeff mentioned, the bond market, has become an increasingly interesting alternative as well, to either be done in conjunction with some bank financing or instead of bank financing.
Right. Nick, is the availability of capital through whichever process, whether in the U.S., Norway, et cetera, providing too much capital in order for companies to order ships and potentially hurt the recovery, or do you think it's just right?
I don't know if it's just right, but I think there's obviously been, at this point, upwards of billions of dollars of equity raised, and fundamentally most of the money flowing in has been in the form of equity, whether it's been into assets or vehicles or whatever else directly. In some sense, the scary thing is that the reported numbers are also dramatically understate the actual amount of capital raised in terms of there's been many, many private placements that have been done in the space that don't show up on league tables. We ourselves have done three, and I can assure you they don't show up on anyone's sort of league table. And I know that we're not clearly the only bank. There's lots of banks out there doing private placements. So in that regard, if you were to actually add up the true number of equity raised over the last 12 to 15 months, it's been rather substantial. But having said that, in the large scheme of things, we think that the actual order book, the amount of capital that's been deployed to date, is not worrisome in the big picture. If you look at the scale of dry bulk carriers, there's 10,000 dry bulk carriers. Even if you add up all the collective orders from publicly backed vehicles that have been done, it's in a couple hundred range of new vessel orders. Now, I think the bigger question that lingers over us is not the capital raised and the additional capital to come, but it's sort of a theoretical fear because you don't know whether it will come and how it will come, is if the traditional end users that have to date been absent from investing really in shipping. A lot of the state companies, the end users that don't necessarily care what the order book looks like. If they want to order ships for their demand, they will order them. And you know, if those guys, you know, down the road enter the market regardless of what the order book looks like and want to go order, you know, 50 VLOCs like Vale did when the Cape market was already dramatically overtonnaged and everyone knew it, that's their prerogative. And that's the one thing that, you know, keeps us up at night in terms of not the amount of capital that's been raised from the equity markets or related institutional investors. It's that's fine. The question is, if end users come back in years from now, ignoring what's been done to date because a lot of the capital has been raised from non-traditional players, where will that leave the market? But fundamentally, in terms of what's been done, I think it's well within sort of the reasons and historical trends.
You know, Wall Street has an expression for bull markets where we say, when the market's going up, the market climbs a wall of worry. I often think that shipping's exactly the same way. You know, when things are getting better, it's just natural for us to say, well, I know they're a little better, but you know, but someone's going to ruin it before it's even fun, right? And who's the bad guy going to be this time? Private equity, or else it's this greedy investment bankers taking companies public. Whatever it is, it's going to be natural to worry about it. But I think it probably happens in every bottom of the cycle that shipyards make the ships so darn cheap they're going to be ordered, and eventually this nascent upcycle will flatten out and turn down. But in the meantime, I think it's got some legs.
And if I could just add, I started out my banking career working in other industrial sectors and spent a lot of time with one of the big three automotive companies in the U.S., helping them with some of their M&A and capital raising. And at no time in that sector did anybody worry about access to capital driving the automotive cycle. And I think that access to capital is only a good thing. And I think that one thing that is unique about this industry in terms of the liquidity of assets and buying and selling and supply demand is that it is really a very efficient market, and someone wins, someone loses. And there's lots of smart people through the years who have made money in shipping, and there's lots of smart people who have lost money in shipping. And it's those competitive dynamics of the market which is going to drive the next cycle, not too much capital available. I do think that the discipline of the capital markets is something that's good for shipping in terms of going away from purely those who have a historical name having access to capital. There's a renewed focus on perhaps the metrics, but the equity markets, the bond markets alone aren't going to drive the next down cycle.
Great. Liz, what can you tell us from a U.S. perspective about the Norwegian OTC process? Is that looked at as a competition to the U.S. or perhaps either a stepping stone or something else?
No, absolutely not. And I think you're going to be hearing more about it in a bit. But I think that's definitely viewed as a kind of a great stepping stone for companies that aren't quite ready to access the U.S. public market. So it's an excellent way, I think, for smaller companies to grow when they're not quite ready for a U.S. public listing.
Not just that. I don't disagree, but I think it's an alternative, and it's Eric. With all respect, I love the title of your next section of today's program, which is investing in Norway. But as I've said publicly before, I really think it's investing through Norway, because what Plateau and his esteemed competition can do is use a process to get at investors, some of whom are in Norway, but many of whom are in the U.S. in a very expeditious way, and I have Plateau on speed dial. I mean, I have clients I've referred to, to say the best thing for you is a Norwegian process. So it is complementary. That's the best. I don't think it's always necessarily a stepping stone, but certainly it's just another alternative for our mutual clients.
Krista, I guess. We got the yellow light. I guess final question. What keeps, and this is really open for the whole panel, but what keeps you up at night when you're trying to bring a company public? What worries you the most about the difference between success and not?
That's a tough question, but I would have to say, as a banker, it's that constant struggle between the culture of pushing for the absolute lowest price at one point in time at the sacrifice of setting a company up for long-term success. And we see this in IPOs all the time, which is there's a market clearing price for a company, and it becomes a judgment call where you price that equity. If you price it really high, you lose some demand. If you price it really low, you bring in demand, and no one wants to leave any money on the table. But part of the art of taking a company public or just raising equity for an existing public company is knowing how to strike that balance to get the best price for the company and to set that company up so that the stock trades well, so that investors are buying more. And they can come back and access the equity markets fairly quickly thereafter.
Well, thank you so much to the panel. I guess I'll open it up to questions. We have maybe time for one or two questions if there is. Otherwise, I guess you guys were similar to the private equity panel, comprehensive. So thank you so much for your time.